no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a cop.
It's just me, Andrew.
How'd you play out there, Dan?
Well, I found the conditions challenging. Mostly because there's no grass on the golf course. But there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag. I love the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trashy.
What is happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is your host, Alex Dixon. We are at episode 80, number 80. Got a good one for you today. We've got a legend in golf from these parts. Gentlemen, I've been trying to get on the show for quite some time. Finally got back to me via email, and we set up a recording. Mr. Fred Funk. If you're not familiar with his resume, is from the DC area, played his college golf at University of Maryland, went on to become the head golf coach at University of Maryland, and then worked his way onto the PGA Tour and had an extensive career, won 8 times on tour, with his biggest win being the 2005 Players Championship, which just happened last week, at age 48. He's been playing on the Champions Tour. He's got a son who's been competing on the Corn Ferry Tour, who played at the University of Texas. And he's got a lot of stories to tell. He's got a lot of opinions. Only had about an hour with him. Probably could have talked for a long time. Might try to get him on again in the future. But he was one I've been trying to get for a while. So excited to have Fred Funk join the Beltway Golfer Podcast. We got the second and third episode of the Surrender Birdies podcast, the new, more conversational podcast versus interviews that we launched last month. That is more just talking local golf and our own rounds and what's going on here locally. So if you haven't checked out the Surrender Birdies podcast, give that a listen and let me know what you think. That's going to come out every couple weeks, along with continuing the Beltway Golfer Podcast. Sponsor for this episode, Pinned Golf. If you're not familiar, Pinned Golf is an upstart brand in the rangefinder world. They make high-quality rangefinders in a variety of colors that don't break the bank. They also make a variety of really cool speakers for the golf course, and they've got a bunch of swag as well. PinnedGolf.com. And guess what? We got a promo code. If you enter code Beltway at pingolf.com, you get 15% off. And at the same time, you're supporting this podcast. So you're in the market for a rangefinder or you've got an old one, go check out pingolf.com. Follow them on social media at pinnedgolf, PINNED golf. Let's get to the conversation with Fred Funk. One other mention he tells at the very last thing I bring up with Fred Funk is just a few episodes ago, a couple months ago, I sat down with Jim Estes, who is now a teaching professional at Blue Mash Golf Course. He was a player for University of Maryland golf when Fred Funk was the coach. And Jim said, not much, but in that interview and podcast with Jim, mentioned how they had a rocky relationship and added a little bit of color in that podcast. So at the very end of this conversation with Fred, I gave him an opportunity to kind of verify that or kind of respond in a way. But, and keep in mind, these guys are great friends nowadays, but maybe had a rocky relationship 30 years ago as player and coach. Anyway, Fred, you'll have to listen to it, but he does tell a very colorful story about their time as player and coach, and particularly an incident with Jim. And for anybody listening and or wondering, after the conversation, while I was editing, I did talk to Jim Estes to make sure he was cool with me leaving the story in, which he was. You know, they may have some, you know, a difference in memory as far as the exact details of how it went down. But I was glad to hear that Jim laughed about it and was real cool and said, go ahead and leave the story in the podcast because it's a good one. It's pretty funny. But both guys are really good friends nowadays. But that's at the end of the podcast. Thought I'd mention that. Anyway, let's get the conversation. Here it is, episode 80 of the Beltway Golfer Podcast. Here is Fred Funk. Enjoy.
All right, Mr. Fred Funk, how are you? Thank you for joining the Beltway Golfer Podcast. It's a pleasure.
I'm really good. It's kind of exciting for me to talk to somebody from home.
Well, so here's my a couple things right off, because we're talking literally on the Friday of players, but you said from home, you haven't lived in the DC area for decades now, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, I moved out in 91 to Jacksonville, Florida, Ponte Vedra. And yeah, it's been a while, but I mean, I grew up there. I grew up at the University of Maryland, at the University of Maryland golf course, went there. I mean, I'm homebred through and through. Sure.
Do you get back up to this area ever?
Yeah, when golf brings me that way, my whole family followed me down, my mom, dad, sisters, brother. I didn't want them to, but they followed me down to Florida. So I really don't go back except for, I did go back this last fall. It was the Penn State Maryland game, and we had a two-day golf mini reunion. We didn't get enough guys or as many guys as I wanted to, but I saw a lot of the guys that were in my era when I was playing and coaching.
Nice. So I'm going to tell, let's start off. We'll go even further back than Maryland, but I have you went to high school in Beltsville at High Point High School. Is that right? Playing the golf team there?
Yeah. We call it a high joint, but yeah, High Point.
Do you remember what was your home golf course? Remember?
We played a lot at Gunpowder Country Club.
Okay.
And old Greencastle Country Club.
Greencastle, I don't know. I don't think that's
the Well, it used to be out off 29, and it was a good golf course, but they bulldozed it for homes. Because D.C. went through that era where Washingtonian was a great club, and a lot of, All View out there, and numerous clubs. They just, for a while there, we were losing more golf courses than you would really expect to, and they certainly weren't building them. So Greencastle was one of them that took the hit and became homes.
Yeah. It's interesting to look at some old maps of the golf courses around the region before the sprawl really happened. Like the Washingtonian, that was a little bit before my time. But now that's been a sprawling shopping complex called the Rio.
That was a big one. That was the one I was thinking of that I couldn't come up with the name was Washingtonian.
Yeah.
Do they still have Germantown?
Germantown? No.
That was a great little golf course. It was
just called Germantown Golf Course?
Germantown. It was right off 270. You could see it. A couple holes from the highway. And off to the left if you were heading to Frederick. And it was really a good course.
Some of these are hard to track when with questions like that, because as they've changed ownership, sometimes they change, they'll change the name. Gunpowder, though, Gunpowder is still surviving, although, and it's still family owned. I think it's subsidized by the county a little bit. But someone actually just sent me a message literally just like a week or two ago saying that they were facing some pressure from the county in one way or the other. So I don't know how long Gunpowder is with us, but Gunpowder is an interesting place. It's still surviving. And it's to this day, it has this very mom and pop feel to it.
Yeah. Well, the pop built it and cleared the land, built it, just did everything. And it had some good holes on it. You had to definitely control your golf ball there. But that was our home course. We played there quite a bit. We went out to Indian Springs a lot back in the day. That we renamed Nobody Springs, but it was a 36-hole facility there. I think that's not there anymore.
No, that's one I played during my high school golf days. But yeah, that's another one that's been gone for quite a long time. That was a great facility in Silver Spring. So you went on. I did some other podcast listens in a little bit of my research before this interview. But the main one that anybody listening to, that I'm going to try not to repeat. Or some of the questions, and so you're not repeating yourself, because you did one about a year ago with Colton Ost and the Subpar guys.
Yeah,
I thought that was a great podcast. But there was a couple tidbits I got to bring up from that I didn't know about you. But one of them, so like moving on from high school, you went to University of Maryland for a bit, but did you fail out of Maryland and then went to community college and played golf there?
My freshman year, the fall of 75, I go to Maryland and I'm trying out for the golf team. Dave Ziegler was a coach, and we had two All-Americans were on the team then. That was just coming out of an era where somehow Dave was able to recruit guys from the South and all over that were really good. And we had Roger Simpkins, Mike Pratt were honorable mention All-Americans, and other guys that were really good players. So they were pretty deep.
but they had 12 rounds of qualifying at the university course, which I grew up on. And I finished 13th. They kept 12 guys, 12 rounds, 12 guys, and I finished 13th. I made the last day on the second hole to par three. I hit it in the dry creek left of the green. I tried to play it out and ended up making a 12th, and that killed me. And I mean, if I make a par or bogey on that hole, I finish like seventh or eighth. And he cut me. And then I flunked out on top of that, and I went to PG Community College after that year. And then when I got my associate degree, I went back to Maryland and I lost half my credits. I got law enforcement degree from there. I got an AA law enforcement degree, and then I finished that up at Maryland. I wanted to be a cop there for a while. The one thing that was really funny was that, and ironic, was when I went to PG Community College, all the guys that were, God, we had seven guys that were the number one players from all the respective PG County high schools mm-hmm. that we played against. We all played against each other. And we all showed up for some reason. We all showed up at PG Community College, and Montgomery College was the dominant team in that area, and nobody could ever beat Montgomery Community College. And we destroyed them 2 years in a row. And then we went on to the Nationals both years, and we scrimmaged Maryland one day in Maryland. We had our starting six against Maryland. They had three starters and three second team guys, and we destroyed them too on their home course. So we had a heck of a team.
Wow. I gotta imagine that's obviously an anomaly, but you know, even a community, I mean, like I did 2 years at Montgomery College myself. I was also a community college guy. I played basketball at Montgomery College, but I don't even remember them having a golf team, to be honest with you.
No, they had a heck of a team. They had,
really,
they had guys that were, you know, the country club kids. Cause I felt like I needed a passport to get to Montgomery County if you're a PG County guy.
So you ended up over at University of Maryland, you played your golf there. And then, so what was your path from there? Did you try to become a professional golfer? You try to qualify for the tour right out of school, or like, what was that period before that kind of you became a coach?
No, I was like the top two players when I went back, and we had a good team. We had a pretty good team, but we weren't really that deep. And I graduated December of 80. I actually finished my degree, which was a miracle. And then I went down and played the Space Coast Mini Tour in all of 81.
Okay.
And I made enough money in the spring to keep going in the summer, and then enough in the summer to go to the fall. And then I went belly up and didn't have a good fall. And I came back, I was working manpower, cleaning out a burned out warehouse in DC. And in the middle of the winter, I looked like a coal miner when I got home every night. And freezing. And I was like, sheesh, this can't last long. And my coach got promoted. Randy Hoffman got promoted to assistant athletic director and said, Fred, you want to take over the team? I went, yes. And I said, well, how much? And it didn't matter. I said, not that it matters how much it pays, but what's it paid? And it was only 18 grand a year. And I go, I'm in. But I could play all the golf I wanted. I still had to work to shop. I was an assistant pro. So if we weren't in season, I would have to work 35 hours a week in the shop, but I could play a lot of tournament golf. So I played golf with all the kids, and I'd practice with them. I would play against them when they were head qualifying, or play with them. Go on the road, I'd practice with a couple other coaches, and I kept qualifying as an assistant. I won the national assistants in 84, and then I kept qualifying for PGAs and US Opens and making cuts. And in 84, 5, and 6, and I started dominating the section. It was me. Well, a couple of guys were dominant. Webb Heinzelman, me, Wheeler Stewart. Not Wheeler Stewart. Woody Fitzhugh, Clint Baird, a couple other guys were really, really good players. And we had a great section back then. And we'd play every Monday, Friday in pro-ams. And I think what really helped me in that was kind of a funny thing, correlation to it, was that we would play the white tees with the amateurs we brought. So we're playing courses from 6,100 to 6,300 yards. And par was like 68, 67. And I got used to shooting 63s, fours, fives all the time. And when I went back to the back tees playing in real tournaments, I got used to shooting low, and I expected to, now I was comfortable being in the 60s or way under par. And I think that's the one thing that really changed my game a lot was because I was never a real long player, never had power, but I was big time control guy. You know, I just hit drop bait, didn't curve the ball. I'm still the same game, never changed. But I got used to shooting and pretty much dominated the section for those 3 years. And then I tore a rotator cuff at Woodmont in a pro-am. 3-iron got stuck in a tree when I was trying to chip out, and I tore my rotator. And that threw me off for about a year and a half. I never had it operated on at that point. And then I qualified for the tour for the 89 season. So I left coaching.
To play like in the like the assistants open and stuff like that, and even playing in the section events, at some point in there, did you have to go through like becoming a PGA professional, or did you because you were the coach?
Oh yeah, I had to go to business schools, pass the player ability, which was a joke. I mean, all you do is shoot, you play 36 holes in one day and shoot like 155, you're in. And when I could do that, I actually went over to, golly, I forgot the golf course now. It was a public course in Montgomery County, and it was fogged in. I played the first 18 holes and couldn't see 200 yards. And I shot 63, and then I went back out and cleared up, and I shot like 65, blew through that, and got my business school to be a, you know, back then it was two business schools, and I passed that. And so I became a PGA member.
Nice.
And all that time. Yeah.
You mentioned, I read about that, Webb Heintzelman. I know he was a player. You mentioned his brother has had a business, folks listening. He's been running
club golf repair.
Club repair shop in Bethesda called Bethesda Golf Care Center for years and years and years.
Yeah. Wade, he was a great guy. Really. Well, Webb was a great guy and is a great guy. And Wade was super. He was the guy, and it was unbelievable where he was. He was right there in Bethesda in the main part of the town. And it had to be expensive. Even back then, it had to be expensive to pay the lease or rent on that space doing club repair, for Pete's sake.
He's still affording it somehow. I went over there a couple of years ago, and you know, he was packed. One appointment after another. So he's doing something right.
Oh, he still got the business?
Oh yeah, he's still going. Oh,
man, you got to tell him hi for me.
I will.
Wade's awesome, and his brother Webb was a hell of a player, a really, really great player. He just we both qualified the same year, and he was the can't miss kid, and I was the guy that won't make the tour. And yeah, I went on. He got injured, and what I remember, he hurt his hand, wrist or hand, and that really never really recovered at that point, and lost his card early on. I think he kept it for 2 years or so, and then he never really got back on tour. And I went on, and I lost my card the first year and got it back, and I never had to go back to Q school. But it was a long ride. I mean, it was a difficult ride early, and it was never easy, for Pete's sake. I mean, it's not glamorous at all, in that other than you're doing what you love to do, but it's really hard. I think the game of golf, when you're kind of running off on a tangent here, but when you play golf for a living, and even probably when you don't play golf and you're a pretty good player, you don't play it for a living, but you're never not thinking about it. You're always thinking about whether, if you're playing good, how do I keep playing good? And if you're playing bad, am I ever going to play good again? And it's always a lot of work. And I had a really strong, and still do actually, but a strong work ethic. I felt I had to outwork guys to beat them. And I worked really hard at my game and trying to, you know, get in shape and do things like that. So it was always a challenge. It was, and I had to have ball control to beat them. And it actually took me probably, you know, won my first tournament in 92, but it probably took me another 2 or 3 years where I really felt like I belonged on tour. So I had been out there 5, 6, 7 years, and I still wasn't comfortable out there until after that. And then I came to realize my game's good enough and I can be out here as long as I want to be, as long as I didn't get hurt. Although I got hurt a lot.
Back then. So by the time, I mean, not to fast forward, but by the time you're, you know, winning it's the time you get like winning the Players 2005. And you know, if you Google Fred Funk now, one of the snippet on Fred Funk is you were one of the straightest hitters of all time, but you're also very short. My question, a short hitter. And my question is, back when you first got on the tour, were you considered a short hitter then, or is it just because players got longer and longer as you got older?
No, I was one of the shortest guys, but probably when I was playing my best was ironically when I was about 42 to 52, I was playing my best golf all the way through that stretch. And I actually saw some of the old baseball cards because I don't really remember a lot of stats. And I'd look at it and I was averaging between 272 and 278, which was long enough then to be competitive because the long guys were only averaging 285, 290. And you didn't have that big spread.
Sure.
So, in fact, Bill Calthy, who's another guy that played for Maryland, was then commissioner of the back of the web.com, but he played a tour for years. And his last year, ironically, I think was 1986 or seven. And he won the, he was always one of the longest drivers, but he was the longest driver that year at 279.
Oh, times have changed.
Times have really changed.
What do you attribute that to, the fact that your best golf was between the ages of 42 and 52? I got to imagine there's not many tour players that have been able to say that.
No, probably not. BJ would be definitely one because he won everything when he was in his 40s. He won 9 tournaments 1 year, I think. But I just had a golf swing that I owned. I was self-taught. I really read The One Move to Better Golf by Carl Lorne, who's another former Maryland player. He's probably got to be 80 now, at least. And he wrote that book, and that was my Bible to golf. And I just, it was pretty simple, basic fundamentals, and still teach people that way. And I still think that way. I'm not all about positions and everything. So I had a swing that just was easy to repeat. And when I had my putter was hot, I was a streaky putter. I was never consistently good putter, but when it was good, it was good. And when it was bad, it was meh. And it was good enough to get myself in contention. Somebody told me, my son, I think, who's trying to get on the tour now, but he told me about a month ago we were home, and he said, "Dad, you realize how many top 25 you had?" And I said, "I have no idea." And it was some ridiculous amount. I played 650 events on the PGA Tour, and I made over 450 cuts, I think. And I had some ridiculous amount of top 25s, which I had no idea, which is pretty good golf, you know. So actually, when I look back and somebody tells me so, I was a better player than I pictured myself. And I wish I believed that. That was the problem, where I didn't believe as how good I really was at the time. I wasn't a great, I wasn't flashy, I wasn't anything, but I was consistent. I was really like watching paint dry. I'm just down the middle on the green.
That's interesting. You think nowadays you get so many tour players that use mental coaches and kind of like sports psychiatrists. Do you think, was there anybody using mental coaches back in your day? And B, do you think, did you use one or could you have used one?
Yeah, I did. I had a couple. I read Bob Rotella's book, Golf's Not a Game of Perfect. Mm-hmm. And I won that week. My second event. So then I figured, geez, I could just read a book, and thinking I'll read a book and I'll have my mind in a great place and I'll do it again. And I never did it again. But I did see Bob in person. We worked together for a while, and I saw a guy named Lanny Basham, who was an Olympic rifle shooter and became a mental coach. And yeah, they're all really bring to the surface the obvious, how you're supposed to think. And it's funny that my caddy and I came up with this, that if you really thought like a caddy, that's the best swing, that's the best mental program you could possibly run, because all the caddy cares about is the shot at hand, and he's giving you the yardage, he's giving you all the information so you can hit that shot. Whether you do it or not, the next shot he does it again. He's going to give you all the a good caddy does that. He's going to give you whatever information. The shot that just happened doesn't matter. It's all about getting the ball. If you hit it out of play or almost out of play, how do you get back into play? And so a caddy's mentality is the perfect sports psychologist.
Interesting. I wonder if, do you know of any caddies that have gone into that business after they're kind of.
Yeah, there's a few. Really? Fanny, who caddied for Nick, and she caddied for me for 1 year, caddied for Sergio when she dropped with Nick. And now she's a in Europe, she's a big time mental coach. She was Fanny Sunesson.
Okay.
Worked for Nick Faldo forever when he was winning.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Yep. So again, we're talking on day two here, Friday of the players. What is, you know, as a past winner, it's been 19 years since you held up the trophy. Are these days or is this week? Do you get a lot of requests even today?
Well, this year I didn't come back home off the road. I'm actually out in Phoenix. So we played last week in Tucson and next week in Newport Beach, and I didn't want to go all the way back and then fly back across. So, but normally I'm there and I'm doing corporate visits, all those tents around 17, sure. 16. And I'll just go from tent to tent to tent and just say hi to everybody and make a little bit of money that way. And I just didn't do it this year. But I do watch. I love watching it. Yeah.
I imagine. So, yeah, I mean, you pulled off that win. I think it's still oldest winner of the players by a significant margin, 48 years old. You know, when you think back to that week, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
How bad the weather was. Yeah, it was terrible. And I only got 40 holes of golf in 4 days. I had 32 holes of play on Monday. So we had a Monday finish. A lot of people don't remember. And it was a bright sunny day, but the wind was blowing 30 to 35 sustained winds. And we had a 42 mile an hour gust. It was brutal. And it ended up playing right into my hands. I didn't know it, didn't think it at the time, but all the bombers were hitting the ball. You know, they hit it real high. I was playing with Adam Scott, who was the defending champion, and Vaughn Taylor. They're both long hitters. And they couldn't get mowers out there. It's been so wet. So the rough was, you just couldn't go in a rough. It was like a hayfield. And all the bombers hitting it up in the air, and the wind's blowing them over into the rough, and you couldn't get out of it. So they couldn't score really well. And I literally, that week, my fairway stats, I never hit it in the high stuff. I missed one fairway and I was in the first cut all week, even on that Monday with 32 holes. And I shot 65, 72, and then I had to finish my third round on Monday, and I shot 71 somehow. And I think I heard just yesterday, because I was on another show with Chantel on Golf Channel yesterday, and she said the stroke average for that third round was 76 point something. And then we didn't repair, and I went back out, and I got off to a slow start. And I knew I was behind, and I saw I was about three shots behind, but still in it. And because a lot of guys shot low, my 72, I'd lost some ground because the weather was, you know, was soft. It's like it is this week. Sure. The grains are soft, and whenever the grains are that soft, the scores are pretty low there. And when the fairways are soft. But anyway, I ended up going on a birdie streak. I think I birdied 7, 8, 10, made a great par on 11, birdie 12, 13. And I had a three-shot lead on the 14th hole. And I didn't want to see the leaderboard. Normally I do, but I did. And I went, crap, I didn't want to see that. And my caddy goes, what's wrong? I said, well, it's my tournament to lose. He goes, come on. So it's, sure enough, I three-putt 14, three-putt 15. I had a 20-foot eagle putt on 16, missed it. Go to 17. There's four groups. There's a group on the green, three groups ahead of us on the tee. Because the wind's blowing so hard, nobody can hit that green. And literally, of those four groups ahead of us, two of every group hit it in the water. So finally, our turn, and all three of us birdied 16. So Adam gets up, hits it in the water. Vaughn gets up, hits it in the water. I was, oh, how the hell you hit the green? And I remember I hit a 6-iron, which normally it's a wedge. And I knocked it underneath the wind. It almost went over, but it was on that top shelf, about 2 feet from where it would have rolled down to the pin. And I ran it by and I missed it coming back. So now I got a birdie or par 18, and the wind's howling off the left, straight into you and off the left. And I probably hit the best drive of my life ever under any circumstances was that drive. I took it right over the boards and I hit it about head high, just a bullet out there, and the wind pushed it out to the middle of the fairway. And I hit a 6-iron in the bunker, and I got up and down out of that bunker. But I remember a lot about that week.
I bet that's wild about them both hitting into the water on 17 right before you. What the score was, not that you remember the exact score, but so those weren't the two guys chasing. There was somebody else, because I would think your two playing partners go in the water, that takes a little pressure off.
No, they were out of it. Tom Lehman was already in the house.
Okay.
And went ahead. And when I finished, Luke Donald and Scott Verplank had to birdie 18 to tie. And neither one did, obviously, thank goodness. And I got the win. So it was pretty cool. What was weird was that because we had to play 30 or a lot of golf on Monday, we didn't repair. So leaders were all over the place. You know, they were all over different groups. So it wasn't leaders in the last group.
Gotcha. Yes, so that's unusual.
Not everybody stayed in contention
right
that way. Especially with it was easy to shoot 80 that day. I mean, yeah. Really.
So it's interesting. So you had already had a handful of wins on tour, but you're 48 at this point. But that's, you know, looking back, that's your biggest win on tour. Did that win, you know, how much did that win at the Players kind of change your, I mean, I don't think it's changing your career at 48, but how much does it change your life?
It really messed up my plan for the senior tour, because now I had a 5-year exemption and I was just ready to turn 50 and, you know, in a year and a couple months and just go right on out there and play full time. But then I had that exemption, and actually in the year I turned 50, the first tournament in Mexico was Mayakoba, and I won that when I was 50 years old, gave me another year exemption. So now I had basically that 5 went to 6 year exemption, and I was trying to play both tours early on my Champions Tour career, which really didn't work very well. You got to commit to one or the other. And I really would have to look back and see how I did that and when I did that. The way I recall, I pretty much committed when I was 52 over to the senior tour.
I also saw, I don't remember this, but so you qualified for a U.S. Open a year after that at age 53 here at Woodmont in Rockville.
Yeah, that was cool. I liked that. That was at Beth.
Right.
Yeah, that was at Bethpage. And what was ironic there, I did a boatload of U.S. Open qualifiers at Woodmont, and I love that place. And I didn't think I made it. And I went to, I went down the road in Rockville. My wife had an event that she was putting on or helping to put on at Kennedy Center. And I had taken a shower and I got my coat and tie on. I've already had one big beer, one 20-ounce beer and a crab cake. And I was drinking my second beer, and all I've had for food is this crab cake for basically all day. And the beers are hitting me, and the USGA calls me up and they say, hey, Fred, where are you? You in a playoff? And I went, you got to be kidding me. I'm in a playoff. And had to put my shorts back on and go over there. And we played, and I was the last, I got the last spot. I think it was 7 guys for 3 spots, and I got the last spot.
So you're back at the hotel getting ready to head down to the Kennedy Center.
Yeah, of course, yeah, I was down the street. I was just down the street. that was real fortunate because I was living in Florida at that point.
Yeah.
For a long time, actually. But, and then I go to Bethpage and my knee was killing me. And I actually had it replaced later that year in 2009. But I made the cut on the number and I finished last of the guys that made the cut. But Bethpage is the hardest, one of the best. It's probably the fairest, hardest golf course you could ever play. It's definitely the hardest course I've ever played, but yet it's still very fair. You just got to hit it good. And it's a beautiful property. It's unbelievable. So I was glad I got to play because I didn't play it in 2002 when Tiger won. I didn't make it. I got the chance to play it in 2009. So that was cool.
Yeah, Bethpage. I played it once. I did it the old fashioned way. I slept in my car a couple of years ago, but got to play it and it kicked my ass. So what's your you've got Ryder Cup experience and you've got major experience at Bethpage Black. Next year, the Ryder Cup is going to Bethpage Black. What do you think that's going to look like, especially with the fans there? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, you said it all with the fans. The New York fans are crazy. They're great golf fans though, and we were playing Shinnecock with Phil in the second to last group when Retief won at Shinnecock. And unbelievable. I played Baltusrol as Jersey, but had the fans. I was paired with Jack Nicklaus on Saturday of that tournament. And that was a nervous wreck. That was a nervous wreck all day. But yeah, I've had some really great experiences where I put myself in contention in a couple of those majors, and I didn't finish them off, but it was fun, especially getting paired with Phil and Tiger and Jack. It's pretty neat because the crowds were so amped up. It's really cool.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. So you were, so you're playing kind of a full schedule now on the Champions Tour, or how many events?
Really. I've had, I just had wrist surgery. I don't know if you can see how swollen this thing is.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's pretty swollen. I played my first week last week in Tucson. I shot 372s and finished 66. So, but I had, my first back operation in 17, and that took my game down. And then I had a second one a year ago. Wow. It's only been a year ago, this month. And, it's feeling better, but it's, I've lost distance. I can only fly a ball, but if I really hit it good, I fly at 240. So that it's hard to compete because I'm going to ask you. So I'm going to throw a question to you. What do you think the average, the golf course we play on the Champions Tour? You take our yearly average. What do you think the length is?
Well, I'm a good person to ask because I have absolutely no idea. I will guess, 6,400?
7,100.
Oh, my gosh.
7,100.
that's long.
It's how long we play. That's our average golf course. So, like, when we go to the Houston Open in Houston, where we used to have the show at Houston, and we go, it's the Insperity for us, but we play the exact tees we played when we were on the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And any of the courses we do. But so we played Cage Valley.
I didn't realize that. That's true.
2 years ago, we averaged, that course was set up just a little over 7,300 yards.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a monster for us. But and it was wet.
I wonder how many people know that. I think most people would assume.
Nobody knows that. They don't believe it. You know, most people say 66, 67. And no, we average 7,100 yards. I mean, we got guys. So 7,100 yard course for me right now is a long one, but you know, we'll shoot it up.
Sure. Speaking of long courses, this is kind of a segue both with the long courses, but also kind of into what you're doing. You designed a golf course in Colorado, Rain Dance National, that opened up a couple of years ago. How did that come about? And the reason I referenced the long, do I have it right that when it opened, or maybe it still is, was the longest golf course in the United States?
Second longest in the world, actually.
Second longest in the world.
8,460 yards. It's, there's a lot of factors into that, but it happened in 09. I had a Lear 31, a private plane jet that we used to travel in with two other guys. And this guy coming out of the downturn in 09 in Colorado wanted to buy it. We had it for sale, but he didn't have any cash. He had land. And I went out there to see, and it wasn't going to work out. So after literally no more than 2.5 hours of driving around and seeing residential, commercial, industrial property, could have had a Perkins pancake house. It was pretty funny. I said, I don't want a pancake house. I want cash. And he drives to this piece of land, the highest point of land, not a tree on it. And he says, Fred, I've been sitting on this for over 20 some years, and I want you to, I always wanted to be a golf course. I want you to design it. I went, Martin, we just met 2.5 hours ago. And he goes, yeah, but I really like you. And I went, okay, sure, whatever. I'm thinking he's blowing smoke up my tootie. And we go to lunch, and he breaks out the topo map. We're on this huge table. Letters are this big. It says Rain Dance. And I went, what's that? Is that the name of that property? He goes, yeah. So that's the name of the golf course. So from 09, it was already named. And then they had these huge arroyos on this beautiful piece of property. It drops 250 feet or almost 5,000 feet. We put fescue grass on it, so it's firm and fast, like Scottish. And we had it at 8,000 yards. It was going to play too short if we had a tour event. It was only going to play about 7,100 yards. So, or a big event. So then Martin, he says, Fred, what's the longest course in the world? He goes, what are you getting at? Or I go, what are you getting at? He goes, I want the shortest guy to ever play the PGA Tour to design the longest course in the world. I called him names. And then we looked it up, and there's one in Shanghai, China at 8,550 yards. And it's at 10,500 feet, which you can't breathe at 10,500 feet. But they had two courses, one in Ross Bridge in Alabama, one in Massachusetts, were 8,300 plus. So we got past those. So we're the second longest in the world.
Oh my goodness. So that the golf course design was not something you intended to get into at all. It was almost him just approaching you on the spot.
No, it was always something I wanted to do, but somebody was going to have to ask me because I don't have a company. You know, somebody said, Fred, you want to do something? And I still feel that way because we don't have a company, but I had that thing designed. Excuse me. I had that thing designed since 2010 and walked it. I brought Harrison Menchu in, who is an architect for Arnold Palmer's group. And we teamed up together to do it. And it was the most fun thing I've ever done. Love it. And if you ever get a chance, you got to give it, let me know and I'll get you set up. You take a group out there. And I'm not recommending the 8400 tees though.
Sure.
Although we have Sam Saunders, Arnie's nephew or grandson, and a Corn Ferry guy shot 67 from all the way back, and it's 500 and pretty cool. But it's beautiful. You got to look it up on the website.
I did. Oh. No, look, it looks gorgeous. Oh, you did. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. But if I do get out there, that course record is safe.
Yeah, I can't go back there. Right? I got carries that I can't carry anymore. So I got to play. I can play it at 7,800. The next tee's up. We had the Colorado Amateur already. We were a year old last July, and the week we were a year old, we were hosting the Colorado Amateur. We had 70 really good, obviously amateurs, and they played it at that tee up. And I was hoping 8 to 1200 would win, but 4 under won. I didn't want it to beat them up as bad as we did. But the golf course is new, and the greens are hard as the rocks, and it's hard to get it close.
So changing subjects quick, you mentioned earlier your son, Taylor,
who's
a golfer. He's actually one I got your email address from. I reached out to him on social media and said, I said, this is an awkward question, but I got this podcast. I'd love to have your dad on. He was nice enough. He gave me your, but so he's, how's his career coming on? He played at Texas. Where's he playing now?
He's got conditional in the Corn Ferry. Got there. He played Canada. Played Latin America 1 year, Canada the last two, and he has that status, but played good enough to keep that. But then he got conditional, and he got in his first start at Argentina and second one at Chile the last couple of weeks. Unfortunately, he missed both cuts, so he didn't get in the reshuffle to move up. So next time he gets a chance, he really needs to get a nice cut number, finish to get in that reshuffle, move up, and get in more events. So that's where he's at right now. He's still chasing.
Is that hard? I know you, I think you mentioned in another podcast that he caddied for you for at least a short period. But is that, I imagine as a father, that's, you know, kind of hard to watch your son, you know, miss a cut.
Yeah. Well, it is because I have unrealistic expectations or wants, I guess, because I don't want him to ever have a bad day, miss a shot, miss a putt. You know, it's just unrealistic in golf. You don't do that. Sure. You're right. But, I remember probably the most pressure I ever felt was probably the most pressure he ever felt when he got in the playoff for the national championship against Oregon on Oregon's home course. And it came down to his match and he lost on a third hole birdie in a playoff. And I can't imagine the pressure of that. I mean, Ryder Cup pressure, I think would be something. I wouldn't even think Ryder Cup pressure would be more than what he was going through and that other kid going through, because you're playing for history, you're playing for the team, a coach, yourself, all your teammates. I mean, it's crazy the amount of pressure those kids were feeling.
And that's a level of college golf that your Maryland teams didn't get that far, right?
Oh, no. I always had visions the first couple of years where I would try to get a couple of blue chip guys, but I couldn't. We didn't have the facilities to compete. People had we had range mats. That was we didn't have grass they had. I grew up on range mats at the driving range in Maryland. And our course is great. I love the Maryland golf course, but it was never in good shape back in that day. And so we couldn't compete recruiting wise, but I always had one or two really good players and then we'd drop off. And then back then the ACC was the best, strongest college field or college conference in the country back then, with Carolina was always good. Wake Forest was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And Georgia Tech got good and just on and on and on. And they just everybody got good but us.
Shame on me if you have played in it, but have you guys played or thought about playing in the PNC championship, the one, the father son?
We did. We played three times, lost three playoffs. Yeah. No, two playoffs we lost and lost one to David Duvall and his son. So.
Oh wow. That was how long ago was that?
Wasn't that long ago with David. It's been a while. And Taylor was, that'd be a while. It'd be 10. Taylor's 28 and he was 15 the first time we played it.
Okay.
But we only got in three. It was hard to get in that thing because you had to have won a major or players, which I did, but it goes down the totem pole. The guys that have won all the majors that are dads. So you'd start off with Nicklaus and he, you know, back then he played and Raymond Floyd played and Lenny Watkins, on and on and on, all the great guys. So I was always pushed out. And
gotcha. I didn't realize that's how they selected teams. That's interesting.
Well, they used to announce now they're inviting on all that other stuff. So
yeah,
which is great.
The profile of that tournament's really gone up. I think Tiger and Charlie and the Dailies and some of those folks have kind of raised the profile and maybe the ratings of that tournament a bit. Before I let you go, a couple of questions. So one, you know, you don't have to dive too far into that, but you dipped your toe in the podcasting waters for a little bit with a gentleman I know, Chick Hernandez. What was that year? How did that come about?
I think Chick and I, we've been friends forever, and he was doing kind of around that, getting a podcast, or he was doing one. And then I don't know who mentioned it first. I don't know whether he asked me or I asked him. I said, I'd love to do one with him. Or he said, would you like to do one? I said, sure, let's give it a shot. So it was called, you know, Chicken the Hawk. So, and cause of my beak, I'm the Hawk. So I thought it was a neat name with Chicken the Hawk. And, it was fun. We'd had great guests every now and then. And I thought we always had a good guest. And I think one of the best ones we had was Gary Williams.
Basketball. Yeah, I listened to that.
That was great. That was a really good one. And, it was just got to be hard to lock down that window of time and lock down guests.
Yeah.
And it just kind of ran its course where I felt I needed to start concentrating more on what I was doing and then doing that. So it got more difficult than I thought. I really enjoyed it though. I love talking to the guys and get guys start talking about different things like, you know, what you do. And It usually turns into a really good dialogue back and forth. It was really good. And Chick is really, he's a true professional of that thing.
Yeah. And I think since then he's back hosting, he's a local CBS, but he's the lead sportscaster on CBS now. So he's doing well. A couple of things I'd love to bring you up and I want to repeat. So the one thing I think I got a kick out of in that subpar podcast, I had absolutely no idea, was your, as a youngster, your background in boxing, especially on, so you did Golden Gloves in PG County?
Junior Golden Gloves. Yep. It was all the boys clubs in PG County had a boxing team. Actually, when I first started, when I was 8, 9 years old, College Park didn't have one, but Adelphi Boys Club did. And then later on College Park had one, but I stayed with Adelphi and it was that's a rough county. And at the end of the year, we would train from beginning of October and in April, we would have a big double elimination tournament at Andrews Air Force Base. And against all the guys, but Sugar Ray Leonard was my age, my weight, and we kind of progressed up. But I remember when Sugar Ray got in the ring the first time, and you know, at 8 years old, he was about 9 when he first started, I think, the way I believe, remember. But you get in the ring, you put your head down, you just do this. And then you learn, you know, really what you're doing. You learn how to fight and the art of boxing. And I really enjoyed it. I think I enjoyed the training. We got the training, you're always sparring. We did heavy bag work. We didn't have a speed bag, which was ironic. We never had a speed bag. We had a heavy bag and we do a lot of running and we do a lot of jumping and, you know, calisthenics and working out. And then we would spar every night in the basement of the coach's house. And, we had 16 ounce gloves and we put 8, 10 ounces of lead tape around the wrist. So they felt real heavy, but you fought with 8 ounce gloves and your hands felt like they were just hands, not gloves.
Right.
And I remember that. But the discipline, I think, that I learned from that really carried over to.
You got translates to golf?
I think that's why I worked so hard. I just always did. I didn't mind. I loved working out. I loved doing stuff. So
I can see that. I mean, especially going back to how, you know, you're I think you, like you mentioned, your window of being a top pro is much older than most. And I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, but there may be another tour pro who is in their 20s and really isn't, you know, winning tournaments on a regular basis and might have given up earlier and not, you know, hung around to see that kind of those glory years later on.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There's a lot of guys that are, even to this day, I don't know how they do it, but in that era when I was in, guys that were always trying to get on tour and they might have played one or two years and then bounced off, went back to the mini tours. And you'd see them into their 50s and they're still doing the same thing. They never really made it, but they're still trying to make it.
They're still grinding.
It's still grinding. And it's just something that gets in your blood. It's hard to find. If they love the competitive aspect of it, I think that's what keeps them in there.
What's also amazing about that back then is because, especially if you're not winning and you're grinding, especially like you said, over decades to try to get there, it's not like there's tons of guys getting rich like they are now. It's not like there's tons of money.
When I got there, the purses were 400. And then we had our first, I think in 91 or 92, we had our first $1 million purse, which was Doral. And then Houston went up to 1.2. Everybody's like, they can't maintain $1 million purses. How can they do that? And then they kept going up and they went to 1 to 2 to 3, and then Tiger showed up and they went to 6. And Tiger was the guy. And I was fortunate that, you know, that I played my best golf and I was able to take advantage of some of that Tiger money.
Sure.
That we had in the purses. So it was good. That's ridiculous.
Oh, it's crazy.
We could spend a whole show on what I think is going on now. Is it's pretty sad and ridiculous, I think. But
yeah, you know, it's coming back to the players. And again, so that Subpar podcast that you did that I keep referencing, I think it was just based on, I listened to it on YouTube. It looked like it was almost exactly a year ago. And one of the things that came up in that conversation with Colt quite a bit was Rory McIlroy. I mean, you guys, at one point you were talking about, you know, just how he drives the ball, but other times you're talking about that was like kind of in the heart of the LIV PGA Tour split. It just happened. He was kind of really the mouthpiece for the tour and really being the face of the tour at the time. And you mentioned a couple times how his attitude on course seemed like he was in a really good place. And so my question for you now, especially literally just yesterday, day before recording this, he had a couple awkward moments at Sawgrass with Victor Hovland and Jordan Spieth that were drops and him kind of taking a step back off the PGA Tour policy board and everything that's going on. Where do you think his head's at nowadays?
I heard about that. You have to edit that. No, but Rory's done a 180 on how he feels about LIV and where he is on the whole thing. I'm not opposed to his 180. What I'm opposed to is what they've created on the tour. I don't blame the guys for leaving. How do you say no to that kind of money? So number one, that's that. The problem I have was Jay Monahan not negotiating early and going to the table and try to figure something out. It was like, we're the bully. The tour has always been the bully. You guys aren't going to get away with this. And then all of a sudden some players leave. Then they have a tournament. Then they get some sort of, good TV, but they had TV. And then we were losing some of our stars at that point, and we lost all the leverage. And then Monahan comes up with this, or the group secretly releases this new concept of the elevated events and the second tier events. And I think it's really sad. And now Rory really seems like all he wants to do is have a 60, 70, 80 man field, travel around, play $30 million events, no cuts, exhibition golf. Doesn't really mean anything. He's following the same model that the LIV is doing. It's exhibition golf. So I don't get it. I don't know why Rory's against having cuts. It's not going to, he's too good a player to worry about a cut. And cuts are the big deal about, we could do this. Cuts were always a big deal that the media lost how big that is. So when you watch Q School, the guys that are going through qualifying school, they're focusing in. It's fun to watch the guys that are on the bubble, whether they're going to make it or not, because it's not winning Q School. They got, you know, they're going to the tour, the top guys there, the fun stories are the guys that are going to miss it by one or make it by one. And it's changing their whole lives to get there. Well, yeah. The cup thing, there's not a day goes the first day you're still thinking about making that cut on Friday. You want to get to Saturday and Sunday. It meant a lot. So Friday was cup day. They really should focus in on the guys that are on the bubble of making it and missing it more than they did, because it was a big deal. You had to get to Saturday and Sunday to make a check. You weren't getting it. So cuts are a big deal and a big part of the tour. It's the history of the tour. To take that out, because when they had the WGCs, which was Counter and Norman the first time, I was fortunate enough. I played good enough to be in a lot of those. You had top 50 in the world ranking and top 50 on the money list. There were no cuts events. There were found money. You go out there, you go play. It was relaxing. You knew you had four rounds. You knew you were getting a check. And that's not really an everyday tour event.
Right. Totally different mindset, totally different pressure, right?
Total different mindset. So I just don't like, I don't like these elevated events at the $20 million. They had 69 guys in the field for $20 million purse. And they're taking opportunities away from guys to get into these elevated events. And guys need opportunities to play. This is the first year when you're coming out of Q school that I remember that you didn't get into Sony the first tournament in Hawaii. They had over 20 guys didn't get in that field that graduated from the Q school. And that's sinful in my opinion.
Right. I imagine if that new model were to take hold, a golfer nowadays who had a similar career to you may have had a harder time, you know, getting on the tour if that model were in place. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah, I'm still confused right now on where it's going to go and how they're going to make this thing work. How many people lose their card that are on the elevated events, and how many opportunities from the guys in the second tier to move up and get rewarded for good play when they're down here. And have this opportunity to move up, but at the same time, those guys in the second tour, if you make the tour, any tour or those top two tiers, you're playing for $10 million on the bottom level. You're playing for $20 million on the other level. You're going to make a lot of money if you can just play a little bit.
Yeah,
you just got to play a little bit, keep your card, and you're going to be, they really got the purses to the point. You keep your card on the second tier 3 years in a row, you're probably set for life.
Yeah.
So
I can tell that we could talk on this for a line. You could go for hours on this topic. I want to be respectful of your time. But here's my last question for you. And this is doing a total 180 on topics, but I want to give you a chance to respond. I mentioned this to you on email when I first reached out. This was a few months ago. I had a podcast with a former player of yours at University of Maryland. Who said that you guys have become close friends, but you guys had a rocky relationship when a rocky player coach relationship at the University of Maryland, Mr. Jim Estes, who is a coach. He's a coach in this area and he started Salute Military Golf. But he said you and him had a bit of a rocky relationship as a player. He didn't get into it too much on the podcast, but he said, and I'm just curious, I want to give you a chance to what your memory of this was. But maybe you were a little more focused on your own game than coaching. Is that how do you remember it?
Well, I was definitely focused on my game because nobody was good enough to go to the next level, except for a couple. They were definitely. I had a couple guys that were really good. Jim was a really good player, but Jimmy was at University of Tennessee, and he got dumped from that team and came to us. And he was a great player, great ball striker. But he had issues, and I don't know. Well, I can tell this one on the air, but it's a pretty funny story. Okay, I'll tell the story. You see if it's okay. But we're at Sparrows Point up in Baltimore for a qualifying round, and I had a recruit in, and I had to take the recruit back to the airport. And I get a call from the team that night, and there are three of them. They're all on the phone together, kind of one guy talking. And said, "Hey, bro, we had a little problem with Jim today." I go, "What happened?" He said, "Well, he played 17 naked." I go, "What?" He says, "Well, he had golf shoes on." I go, "Really? Naked?" So yeah, it got worse, coach. He said, "Played 18 really naked." And I go, "No, you got to be shitting me." I said, And now, if you've ever been to Sparrows Point, there's a big bay window overlooking 18. It's it's like a early April date, but it was a real warm day, so the place is packed. And I'm thinking, somebody had to see him. Somebody had to see him. So I call up Norm, who's the coach, the pro. I said, hey, Norm, you hear anything from your members? He goes, no. Why are you asking? I said, So I tell him the story, and he goes, he dropped the phone laughing. So Jim shows up the next day. We're back at Maryland, and he's late for his tea time. His group is already, he's in the last group, and his group's already hitting their second shot over the hill on one. And he comes up, come on, I'll hit my drive real quick. I said, no, Jim, you're off the team. He goes, what? So you're off the team. And I said, you can't go to Sparrows Point. You're representing Maryland. What are you thinking, taking your clothes off? I was just having fun. And I said, I'm sorry, Jim, I'm cutting you. And he takes his driver out and swung it at me. And then I said, you do that again. And he did do it again. And I grabbed him by the throat and I slammed him on the ground. And I just was furious. I took everything out of his bag. Take your shit. That bag's mine. And off he went. So he never played for me. And to this day, I still regret that. We became really good friends since then. And he's done an unbelievable job with the military. And I love all that. And I love Jim.
I have to ask the difference between naked and really naked. I'm guessing underwear on 17, no underwear on 18?
Yeah. Yeah. Golf shoes, though. Golf shoes. Wanted to keep the grip. But Jim's a great guy. And really, I'm really proud of him for what he did with his career with the military stuff. That's great stuff.
Yeah. Well, Ali, well, he certainly was. I mean, he wasn't lying that you guys had a rocky relationship.
Yeah, we definitely had a rocky. It was about as rocky as you can get. Yeah, and I agree with him. I was very focused on my game. But I was using, and I told him, I said, guys, I literally told him this. I said, guys, we can have a good schedule because we're in the ACC. We don't get a good schedule because you guys are so good. He says, we're the worst team in the ACC, but we can go up against every team that is better than us in every tournament. It's up to you how good you're going to be. If you want to play good, you guys want to win tournaments, you guys want to go on to try to get to the tour, that's up to you. But in the meantime, I'm going to try to get to the tour. So, and I told him flat out. And yeah. I was focused on me, but I was trying to use my example of work ethic to carry over to them, but it never did.
Well, that's a great story. Listen, this I'm gonna let you go. This has been great. I feel like we could keep talking, but this has been perfect. And I know you're a busy man. This has been great. I really appreciate you coming on and chatting golf, especially on short notice. And good luck on the rest of the year on the Champions Tour and watching your son and watching the players the rest of this weekend.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. All right, you take care, bud.
Okay, you too. Really appreciate it.
All right, anytime too.
I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about D.C. golf.